the, well, no, I've got to wait for the microphone to get hot.
Bingo.
Now I'm going to open the meeting, the House Committee.
Doing all right, Dave.
Thank you. The House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities will please come to order. We have carryover, well, actually, first, before we get into that, I've got three items that are in your folders that are items sent in to add to our record on the Elliott from the Chief of the State Forest Division, the Whopper hearing from Doug Hike in Oregon Wild, and Ivan Malewski on the Federal Forest Advisory Committee. They're in your folders. Just want to acknowledge that they'll be added into the record. And with that, we're ready to maybe move our first bill, at least hear it, and supposedly at least move it. We'll see. So I'm going to open a public hearing.
Let's see.
Depends what mood shop is.
So I don't open a work session until after we decide if we're going into a work session, right? Thank you. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2213.
You're doing better tap the gavel.
Yeah.
And we have copies of the bill should be in your folder. Our committee administrator is going to give us a description of what the bill does briefly, and then we will have someone from the Oregon Department of Agriculture come up and talk to us about the bill.
You can bring them up while I'm talking.
Okay. Whoever it is, Lisa, you start making your way up.
House Bill 2213 places the Invasive Species Council within the State Department of Agriculture. It expands the council membership. It gives the council power to enter into contracts and other agreements. It gives the council authority to adopt rules and take other actions. It appoints the department as fiscal agent of the council. It deletes requirements that the council appoint a coordinator and that appointment be by written order filed with the Secretary of State. It allows the State Department of Agriculture to enter into interagency agreements with the Department of Environmental Quality for sharing of council administrative expenses, and it declares an emergency effective on passage. Do you want me to mention these?
Yeah, he might.
On the FSRIS, we have there's a notice of no revenue impact in the file and a minimal expenditure impact.
Welcome.
Well, good morning. For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And with me is Dan Hilburn, the Administrator of our Plant Division, who works very closely with the Oregon Invasive Species Council. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you about House Bill 2213. This bill provides clarity to how the Invasive Species Council functions in state government. When the council was created back in 2001, it was created as, I think the best description is, a quasi-government entity made up of both agencies and private entities. It doesn't have a permanent budgetary home or fiscal home the way it's created in statute now. And over the past year or so, as the council has been ramping up and looking at projects and looking at opportunities for grants, one of the issues that has come up is how do they access grants? What tax ID number do they use? And also the issue of asking for permission from the e-board for those monies to apply for them and to receive them. And so this bill specifically clarifies that by making them part of the Department of Agriculture and allowing the Department of Agriculture to be their specific fiscal agent. In addition, as invasive species issues have increased in the state over the last several years, DEQ has interest in participating in the council and being a part of the council as well, and made that specific request. This bill proposes to add DEQ as one of the member agencies, but also to add an additional at-large seat so it maintains the balance between agencies and other entities as well. And I think with that gives you a summary of the main points of the bill. We're happy to walk you through it line by line. Dan's prepared to do that if you would like, or we can answer questions. Your pleasure.
Well, why don't we take a shot at questions and see if that ends up resulting in starting to go through it line by line anyway. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Yeah, I read the bill this morning, and I only have one
question that really jumps out at me, this idea of sharing expenses. And the reason I ask is I don't like money just slushing around. The intent of this bill is strictly to fight invasive species. There is no intention to use this money in any other area of the law, correct? And I'll be very specific. I'm talking about use for cap and trade or marine reserves or locking up any future resources. There's no intention to do anything like that, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, this bill and this program is designed specifically to deal with invasive species. The program in the current biennium is funded one-third with lottery funds, one-third with other funds, and one-third with federal funds to pay for the contract administrator. In the governor's recommended budget, the program is proposed to be funded with other funds and federal funds, that lottery fund component. And I believe there still is some lottery fund, but there's an additional other funds and federal funds. But that is around the fighting the invasive species issues and on-the-ground work around invasive species.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you very much. So each of the members will pay their own way with respect to it, as it has been in the past. So staffing and stuff will not go through ODA. Each of the members of the Invasive Species Council will be paid for by their respective agencies. Is that correct?
For the record, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm Administrator of the Plant Division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, that's correct. The way it works is that agencies assign somebody to be their representative on the council, and those agencies cover the expenses related to that duty.
Follow up?
Yes, Representative Roblin.
We had a long discussion about the idea of having a fund somewhat like the fire fund with respect to having an invasive deal. With this moving there, it looks as if that would probably become a job, if we actually do that, of ag as opposed to forestry or whatever. As you look forward, do you see, is the department committed to looking at those kinds of issues and housing those things as well, if that were to come up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, the bill specifically clarifies for the budgetary purposes putting the invasive species in our agency. I think as these issues arise or the program changes, it'll be an ongoing discussion with the legislature and the affected entities about how the council should operate into the future if their role continues to increase.
Okay. That's good.
We have some members of the public that are going to testify as well. So,
okay.
For now, you're relieved. Terry Witt.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I brought up Mark Sitzma, with the Invasive Species Council. My name is Terry Witt. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'll be very brief today. I'm also in my second term as a member of the Marion County Advisory Board, Weed Advisory Board, and we obviously deal with considerable invasive species in the Marion County area, and I'm currently a new member of the Invasive Species Council Advisory Board. I think we all know that invasives in Oregon are a very serious problem. It's getting worse as our funding is obviously very very tight, and we're shifting funds to other critical needs. We are really concerned that on-the-ground money for dealing with invasives will be less and less. We're hopeful that there will be some significant amount of money coming from the federal government to deal with these programs at the state level, but they have as many budget problems as we do here in Oregon. I just wanted to make one or two quick points, and then I'll be glad to answer any questions. I think we've all heard of the invasive species of great media coverage, things like the gypsy moth and Japanese beetle. We've heard of the diseases, as you talked about, one of your previous hearings, sudden oak death, things like Swiss needle cast, in plants like tansy ragwort and in Scotch broom. But we're also facing some really, really potentially serious invasive species in terms of invertebrates. And, excuse me, most notably the zebra mussel and its cousin, the guaga mussel. For those of you who have never seen these little critters, they're about the size of your fingernail. They're a freshwater invasive species that in many cases comes in ship ballast water. But these critters are so prolific that a female lays a million eggs, about 1% of them survive. So you basically have, in one generation, you have 1,000 offspring. The next generation, then you would have 100,000, or excuse me, a million offspring, and after that, a billion. So every generation that they keep reproducing, you wind up exponentially increasing the number of these little invasives. And they follow everything from boats to harbors to water pipes, and they are extremely, extremely problematic once you get them to try to get rid of them. So I would just encourage you, we support the bill wholeheartedly. We think putting it under the Department of Agriculture, the Invasive Species Council, is a wise move. And we urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Hey, Mark, did you want to chat with us a little bit?
Just
good
briefly.
To see you again. Well, I think I've seen you once or twice, but we've known each other 14 years now.
Right, exactly. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Sitzma. I'm the immediate past chair of the Invasive Species Council, and I'll just be very brief. The council's supportive of this bill. We had a really good year last year with lots of activity with the Silent Invasion documentary. We had an Invasive Species Summit, and we raised quite a bit of money to start working on an assessment of invasive species in Oregon. What sort of the gaps are there in the laws, regulations, who's doing what, just to get everything on in one place, in one page, so we can make some determination and recommendations of the best ways to move forward. So again, the council is supportive of this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions about the council or the bill.
Representative Krieger.
Yeah. Hello, Mark.
Hi.
Mark has been telling the state of Oregon, Mr. Sure. Chair, for I don't know how many years to get out in front of this, and we really haven't listened properly in my own mind, because you know, you talk about gorse, aquatic mussel, zebras, mitten crab down south. Now it's all these things are appearing now on ag land, forest land, aquatic weeds of different types, in private lakes and ponds. And I really agree we're going to have some centralized point to focus on this, because it's going to get worse and worse and worse. And the worst is not only what it does to the environment, but the costs and dollars to the state and industry over time. We know what's going to happen with waterways and dams and hydropower. Can you give us just a little brief thing about what we could be looking at with aquatic mussels and zebra mussels regarding power plants and water diversion for irrigation, what that means?
All right. Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, we did a study of hydropower plants on the Columbia River a couple years ago in 2005, and we went to Bonneville, and we went through Bonneville, looked at all the structures that could be impacted by zebra and quagga mussels, for example. These are small mussels, as Terry mentioned, that grow attached to underwater surfaces. And we evaluated all the surfaces that could be impacted and what it would cost to mitigate those impacts. And this is just for the quagga or zebra mussel. And there are 13 hydropower projects on the Columbia that we looked at. Turns out it'd be $25 million a year just to mitigate those impacts in terms of cleaning, maintenance, shutting down, just to manage that one invasive species. And since then, we've talked to people at Bonneville, and they've indicated to us they think that's an underestimate. It could be probably twice that. In terms of irrigation, basically any municipality or industry that uses raw water, that has a pipe in the water, potentially those pipes could be colonized by these mussels and clog them and require them to shut down, clean them up, install redundant systems so they can have one pipe working while they're cleaning the other. That's just one example of impacts, at least $25 million a year.
Thank you.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, and maybe this isn't necessarily for you. I just want to clarify in my mind that right now the Invasive Species Council has no home. It's not located with anyone? Or is this accurate?
I can answer that, Mr. Chair. Representative Beyer, the council has been housed in the Department of Agriculture, and they've sort of acted as our fiscal agent. They manage the, we have a $15,000 per biennium budget, which they manage, and we use that for meeting expenses and things like that. I think the bill just clarifies the status of the council in ODA and allows us to really apply for federal grants. I mentioned we were very successful last year in raising some money for this assessment. That's really, I think, one of the stimulus for this bill is because we quickly found out when you're applying for federal dollars, we wasn't clear, you know, who would the applicant would be, whose federal tax ID number would go on the application to the federal agency. So this bill just clarifies that and allows ODA to act as our fiscal agent.
Okay. Another quick question.
Yep.
And not seeing anyone here from the environment, DEQ, I assume this is an arrangement that they're okay with.
Please.
Chair Klim, Representative Beyer, I've worked with DEQ on ballast water for 6 or 8 years, and just last session, the legislature passed a ballast water bill that included funding for a position in DEQ. So now DEQ has a person that actually manages the ballast water program. Before that, we had the program, but no person. So ballast water is a very important vector for a movement of invasive species. And now that DEQ has a person in charge of that, he's been engaged with the Invasive Species Council all year. Anyway, he comes to the meetings. So I think DEQ is an important player, and this recommendation was also part of the ballast water task force that was operated during the interim, made this recommendation as well. So I think DEQ, well, I can't speak for them. I'm pretty sure they're supportive of this.
I see someone here, so my problem is I don't know a lot of these players right now for the department. So
we're checking. I assume they are in support of the bill, but we're checking. Other questions? I want to nod. Does DEQ support the bill? Is that good enough?
That's good.
Okay. No more questions. We have one additional member of the public, no problem, who would like to testify, David Moskowitz.
Thank you, Chair Klim, members of the committee. My name is David Moskowitz, here today representing Trout Unlimited and the Native Fish Society. Don't get the chance to testify on the same position as Oregonians and food for food and shelter very often. So we're very happy to be able to say that we support this bill as well. Trout Unlimited and Native Fish Society helped sponsor the conference that was held this summer. We think they're doing great work, and so we support the bill, and that's all. Happy to answer any questions.
I see none. You did
Thank
your
you.
Job well. Thanks,
Speechless.
David.
Speechless.
Okay, that's the end of our public testimony. So now, Representative Krieger, I would take a motion.
Hey, Mr. Chair,
close the public hearing and
open a work session.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2213 and open a work session on House Bill 2213.
Hit the devil first.
Wait, now I open a work session on 2213.
Hit it again.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2213 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Krieger moves the things he just moved. any discussion? Representative Roebuck.
I just want to say, having gone to the workshop they had in the summer and seeing all the people there and the interest that this has across every sector in our state. I mean, this is as important as anything we're going to do this session, because until we actually get all in the same, have the same playbook and we're heading in the same direction, we're going to have a difficult time anyway. this solidifies its home. It makes other people who need to be a part of that a part of it. And I look forward to having this bill move through this place fairly quickly and be signed into law, because we can't waste any time. The invasives aren't wasting their time. We need to move on. So thanks for the opportunity.
Representative Gilliam?
Nope, that's exactly what I was going to say.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have called on him first. Just because
so I was quick.
He's an authority figure in my life, as you know. So.
And me, too.
That's right. Representative Krieger?
I wonder if Snowball is a invasive.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Gilliam. This is out of order.
I do have a question.
If he wasn't so old, I wouldn't take that.
Representative Krieger, a real comment or question?
I think what we're doing is great. We're getting it centralized. We're getting, you know, we're going to get a lot of input, but we are going to have to put more funding behind this. And if we don't, this is lip service right now. You're getting the foundation, but we do have to invest in this program.
Well, as your sole member of Ways and Means for the Department of Ag, I'll see what I can do to at least preserve their existing funding and then go after more.
Yeah.
I'm quite concerned about all of this.
That's right.
Representative Roper?
Yeah, I do want to say one other thing, and I think Representative Wingard made a comment a week or so ago that I think is also important, and that is that we have to make conscious decisions about these invasives, and the best way to do that is to have everybody in the room having the conversation. Sometimes we have to say the cost of trying to stop it is much more than the cost that it will prevent. So we make our decisions. You know, Scotch broom,
right?
We're not going to do much there. But this group has to make conscious decisions about how to go and attack things and how to best spend the money and the resources we have. And I agree with Representative Krieger. We're going to have to figure out a way to fund this better. But we aren't going to win all of them. But there are some we really need to win. And for me, that the quagga and the other one, I don't know, as I look at it spread across this country, that it's a winnable one. But the longer you keep it out, the more money you have saved. So anything we can do to keep it from getting and we've been fortunate. We had three states around us that didn't have any. We aren't as fortunate any longer. And so we need to make some real conscious decisions about how do we keep it out as long as we can.
Representative Wingard.
Mr. Chair, I just want to echo my colleague's sentiments and add that this is the kind of environmental work that I think gets broad support and is the kind of thing that we that gets broad support because we can all see what it does and what our efforts will do to make a difference. And it's this kind of locally based environmental work that I am happy to support and I think I actually happen to believe this is the most critical thing environmentally that we can be doing in this state right now. And anyway, I hope that it does. This program does get the funding that it needs to move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're in a work session.
Yeah.
Let's do it on the Senate side. Sorry. Further discussion on this bill. All right. So, seeing no further discussion, how do I do it now? Yeah. I want to take a vote.
Okay.
That's
what
I want.
Make a roll call.
Roll call.
Would our committee assistant please call the roll?
Representative Byron.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Roble.
Aye.
Representative Charles.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Van Orman.
Absent. Excused. Excused. Thank you.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Chair Flynn.
Aye.
Thank you.
Now I don't have enough scripts. I have anything.
Hit the bill. Hit the bill.
Thank you.
Sweet.
The bill moved to the floor. I get to assign a carrier now?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Representative Wingard, how do you feel about carrying this? Great, thank you very much. Okay. One other thing to note, City of Portland Environmental Services also had a letter that's made available to you that will be added to the record. And the State Treasurer's Office has a last-second amendment. I decided not to entertain it because we can't operate quite like that, and it'll have to be dealt with on the Senate side.
That's a scary thought.
Now... Where's my
Representative
Ben Robles?
Thank you. That also will give you another opportunity if they do add it in.
Correct.
Because then there'll be a conference committee. I mean, there's so many fun things that can happen. Or come back to our committee.
Yeah. Let's open our public hearing on House Bill 2216.
Okay.
Do you want to tell us a little about the bill and get our folks from forestry up while we're doing that?
House Bill 2216 modifies certain provisions related to the ability of State Board of Forestry to acquire lands. It establishes Forest Development Revenue Bond Fund, continuously appropriates monies and fund to the State Board of Forestry for purposes of paying certain bond-related costs. It establishes the State Forestry General Obligation Bond Fund. It continuously appropriates monies in the fund to the State Forestry Department for the purposes of paying certain bond-related costs, and it declares an emergency effective on passage.
One moment. Wasn't the last bill you were trying to amend? Excuse me, I'm sorry.
I got the wrong bill.
Okay. No conference committee. Darn it.
Well, you never know.
Great. No, I knew this bill wasn't ready for prime time. I just couldn't believe that I had to try and have a last-second amendment on the last one.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Clem, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I'm John Blackwell, Chair of the Oregon Board of Forestry. And with me this morning is our State Forester, Marvin Brown, and also Laura Lockwood McCall, Director, Office of the State Treasurer of the Debt Management Division. Thank you for this opportunity to talk with you about House Bill 2216. I've just recently been appointed Chair of the Board of Forestry, and I'm honored by this appointment and take very seriously, as does the full Board of Forestry, the broad public interest that exists in maintaining sustainable forests in the state of Oregon. This bill represents two important long-term opportunities for Oregonians. First, the Board of Forestry may have opportunity to buy as many as 100,000 acres of forest land near Gilchrist in central Oregon. We would use bonds to purchase the land. It would be repaid with revenues from our current state forests. We would buy the historic Gilchrist properties to prevent the land from going the way of many other forested tracts in central Oregon, where subdivision has resulted in degradation of the forest land base and permanent loss of forest values. By updating the Board of Forestry's existing bonding authority, which has not been revised since the 1940s, House Bill 2216 would facilitate this purchase. And even if the Gilchrist purchase does not prove feasible, House Bill 2216 would equip the Board of Forestry to act when opportunities to retain working forests arise in the future. State Forester Marvin Brown and his staff have shared information with you about the enormous pressures on landowners to sell their forests for other uses. The potential loss of our working forest land base is becoming a defining issue of our time here in Oregon. When forest land ownership is repeatedly divided, the probability of management for timber production becomes marginal. Wildlife habitat becomes fragmented, public access is lost, risk of fire is heightened, and protection becomes costly and complicated. Although this is a modern-day problem, Oregon has a proud tradition of rescuing and restoring forest lands that were deemed without value. After the exploitive logging and catastrophic fires in the Tillamook during the 1930s and 40s, the Tillamook burn was thought by many to be a worthless scar on Oregon's Coast Range. But with foresight and patient, even heroic, reclamation, the Tillamook is now an extraordinarily valuable resource for all Oregonians. We can view the potential Gilchrist purchase through that same lens. Owned and managed for nearly a century by the Gilchrist family, the Gilchrist tract was managed sustainably even before sustainability was a popular concept. With the death of family patriarch Frank Gilchrist, all that changed. When Oregon could not afford to buy in the early 1990s, the Gilchrist Tract when it came on the market. A limited partnership bought the land and the timber, harvested heavily to retire a high-interest debt, and then sold the land. Cut out and get out is what I consider it. As our economy recovers, these lands will increase in value, along with pressures to use the land for purposes other than forestry. However, their productive value as working forests has much to contribute to local communities and economies. Just as with the Tillamook, foresight, restoration, and time will produce a forest that provides lasting economic, social, and environmental values. For a glimpse of what could be, take a look at the Sun Pass State Forest south of Crater Lake. After four decades of active management, this is a beautiful forest shaped from cast-off and unwanted lands. That forest now provides wood products and jobs, wildlife habitat, public recreation, and about $1 million a year. $1 million a year in annual revenue to Klamath County. Certainly, we face severe budget and economic challenges in Oregon. At the Board of Forestry, we're thinking creatively and in partnership-minded ways about how to make the Gilchrist a productive public forest. Even so, this purchase may simply not be feasible in the end. But that makes House Bill 2216 no less important. In an era when we face permanent loss of forest land, we must be forward-looking. The future is certain to bring other opportunities to use the particular tools that this bill provides. We've heard widespread support for the state playing an important role in keeping working forests intact. The Board of Forestry can do so without using general funds. But we also know there are concerns, including the loss of property tax revenues when land comes into public ownership. We understand the need to keep counties whole until forests begin producing healthy revenues. We will be requesting amendments to clarify the bill's intent in this regard. State Forester Marvin Brown will discuss those amendments. He can also provide additional information about the Gilchrist lands and the prospective transaction. And we also have our bonding authority present. So, Chair Klim, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you, and I would turn it to our State Forester, Marvin Brown.
Welcome. Morning, Claire Tim. Members of the committee, my name is Marvin Brown. I'm the director of the Department of Forestry, and I'll just reiterate a couple of things that our Chair Blackwell mentioned. We have heard a request that we try to build into this bill a way to make sure that counties continue to receive at least the amount of property taxes that they're currently receiving until lands like this become productive enough to generate more revenue for the counties. And we do have an amendment that we'd like to add to do that. The Forest Trust Land Counties reviewed the bill and offered some technical amendments around bonding authority and bonding repayment that we're building in, and our representative from the Treasurer's Office is going to talk to you a little bit more about some specifics on the bonding piece of that as well. You've got a letter from Klamath County, I believe. Commissioner Schweitzer was here in the building yesterday and got the letter back this morning. We've been in pretty constant conversations with them about the possibility of buying this, and they're very supportive. I think it would be a good addition for their part of the world for the state to own this. It does represent, once the lands do become more productive, it represents substantially more revenue opportunity for them than just continuing to collect property taxes. And I don't know that it's here yet, but the Land Conservation and Development Commission is also in the process of providing a letter of support. And the point I want to make there is that we know that, you know, this issue of keeping working forests as forests is an important one for us, but we're not proposing that every solution is to go out and buy public land. It's just one tool. There's a lot of tools that, you know, we're trying to be creative around right now. This is just one of them, is to have a little cleaner, more effective authority to purchase lands when a real unique opportunity comes along. But there's certainly a lot of other ways to keep working for us. So I think I'll stop there and turn it over to Ms. McCall.
Good morning. I had no comments on invasive species from the treasurer's office.
Right?
Other than, I guess, if you think we're invasive species. My name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the director of debt management in the state treasurer's office. I'm not sure if I've seen any of you, but I do bonding 101 classes at the beginning, usually the legislative session,
yeah.
And I've also been doing some presentations for different groups on state debt capacity. Really, my remarks are fairly limited today, other than I have been working with the staff of Department of Forestry over the last few years to develop a package of bonding opportunities for the department. We've looked at both revenue bonds as well as general obligation bonds. I believe at this point the bill shows both. And my comments are really tied to the distribution of revenues and the timing of who gets money first. And this is just an important concept in the bond world. As most investors, they like to be paid first. And so I want to make that amendment or make that suggestion that we need to make that amendment in order to make these bonds both a higher credit quality. If they're revenue bonds, similar to ODOT or lottery bonds, the waterfall, as they call it legally, is we pay bondholders and then we pay ourselves for other operating expenses. It's a requirement in order to get the high-quality rating, which lowers our borrowing costs. If it's a general obligation bond, forest bond that's eventually approved by the legislature, you would have the full faith and credit of the state, and so you wouldn't necessarily have that issue. But then there's another part of the state law in Chapter 286A, which requires the state treasurer to do a calculation of cash flows. And I'll give you an example of where we look at GO bonds this way. While we have full faith and credit, we do 11F bonds for higher ed for dormitories. We do bonds for veterans' mortgages. We do bonds for energy. And in all those cases, they're called self-supporting general obligation bonds. And what that means is the revenue streams are self-sufficient plus a little bit of fund balance that we always know in our heart and in our soul whenever we sell them that the general fund is never going to have to come out of pocket to cover the debt service costs. And so my recommendation for the legislature is that we need to modify and amend this bill and put those revenue streams near the very, very top. I think fire suppression probably comes first because if you don't have a forest, then you don't have any revenue streams upon which to eventually pay your debt. So I would recommend that we amend this bill. It'll make it easier for us in the treasurer's office to give that cash flow certification if we sell general obligation bonds. It'll certainly make it a lot easier for me to, if we do revenue bonds, to sell those bonds. It may be proven possible if there's too little money in the bottom bucket. That's all I came to say. Thank you.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Dan, isn't it? Dan was in my office yesterday and went over this with me, and I hadn't read it yet. And I see the merits in it, but I haven't committed to one way or the other yet, and I look forward to seeing your amendments. But, you know, the state's taken possession of lands in the past with the intent of harvesting at a level that would help counties. That intention and that promise, in my opinion, has been broken. And there's a letter in the paper from Mr. Josie today how it's been broken. Now, I have great reservations about this. I see the merit, and I'm not saying I'm going to vote no, because I think I can get the yes. But I want you to sit right there today and say the intention of this purchase is to keep this land in production at a sustainable level and not some decreased level in the future. I want a clear statement. So 40 years from now, they go back and they say they intended to harvest this property and keep the county whole and with money, revenues from the harvest of that timber. I don't want to hear some long-winded, I want to hear that. That's what I want to hear today, gentlemen and ma'am. The word intention.
Anybody
intention.
Who is willing to say that or something else that you're...
Can you clarify what you mean?
Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, any particular one of us you want to hear that from? Or?
You're fine. You're perfect, Mr. Brown.
Well, I will speak on behalf of the chair with his permission on this. We've been working, looking at the Gilchrist property for a while, well over a year, and it is our intention that it would be a working forest. It would be managed for timber. It's an east side forest, and it's certainly... keeping the stocking at the right level is important for the health of that, if nothing else, but it also represents a good economic opportunity for that area of the state. There is a mill, used to belong to the Gilchrist family, that's located right smack dab in the middle of this property. We've had several conversations with the owners of that mill. They would be excited to see us maintain to actually end up with ownership as well, because they view it as a long-term sustainable supply for them rather than seeing it busted. So that's a little, I'm sure that's more long-winded than you want. The answer is yes. That is
Thank
the
you.
Intention.
Representative Krieger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have several places I want to make some inquiries. Mr. Blackwell, you mentioned right when you started about using funds from current state forests. I don't know if you mean that backs the bonds or that's what you're going to pay for the management, because we've heard that this is pretty well cut over. There's not going to be a lot of revenue coming off. And normally you get, I think it's what, 34% for management, somewhere around that on the state lands. So if you're going to be taking, in other words, what money are you going to use to do the management until you get to a cash flow actually coming off of that land, which might be 15, 20, 30 years or more, especially on the east side? And if you're going to be using money from the current state forest grounds, can you do that and still, it would look like the management you're getting 34% is more than you should be getting if you can take part of that to manage that. So can you still meet your obligation to other county trust lands like the Tillamook Classic? I'll just use that as an example because that's the two biggest ones.
Representative Krieger, of course, we don't know the price of the land yet, and that cruise and that assessment is underway, and so the math on that's still a bit equivocal, but we would not expect the Gilchrist to be contributing those payments in the early year. Certainly not. It would come from the broader forest funds.
I had a couple
more.
Marvin, we dealt with the purpose of the lands rule and definition of greatest permanent value. I would assume that you're going to use that basis or something similar to that in the management of those lands, and out of that's going to come, in my opinion, eventually, not now because there's nothing there. But mitigation of some type, I would suggest, Mr. Chair, you've got legislation. It's a new piece of property. You need to write right into it. In the law, it isn't subject to mitigation. Just take it right out of the hands of the courts. Let's put it in the hands of the managers or forests who are trained to do it, and we'll challenge them in the committee-type process that you had at the Board of Forestry. That's what the management you should be doing. Because what gets in the courtroom, all it does is feed the lobby of the extreme environmental side. I'm not willing to do that at the expense of the forest itself or the counties.
I've got Representative Gilliam on the list. Or did you need a response to that particular idea, Representative Krieger?
Yeah, I'd like to see what they say.
Sure.
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, I understand what you're saying. It is, yeah, our proposal at this point would be that it might be managed under ORS 530, which is the greatest permanent value rule. In previous sessions, when we've brought this forward, we have tried to build in a little stronger language around continuous growing and harvesting of trees and those kind of concepts, and that met with resistance amongst folks to the point where I was concerned that we wouldn't get a bill out at all. And so tried to craft a bill here that I felt like we could get folks rallied around. As I mentioned to Representative Schaffler, we do intend to manage this as a working forest. You know, what happens 10, 15, 20, 30 years down the road, none of us can really predict. But the intention we have right now is to manage it as a working forest.
Just to finish, when we did that on the Clatsop and Tillamook before I left the board, I was very concerned. I talked to you about it the other day, John, of what changing that definition would mean, and I was right. And at that time, I asked staff under Jim Brown to write an intent statement of what we meant. Then it wouldn't be up to the courts. You need to consider doing that.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our guest from the Treasurer's Office, I apologize. I didn't, Laura? I want to take bonding 101. I didn't realize that it was offered. and I'm sure you'll be able to discover from my question that I need to. But nonetheless, I appreciate what our state forester just said about none of us will probably be here or involved. Nonetheless, we are making decisions that have things like 30-year bonds attached to them. And I take that very seriously. We don't have to get into this, but last week I felt that our august body did not take that seriously. So if you could say a little more about why this is a better bet. I see the relationship between the opportunity of this particular forest and the long term, particularly the way it was described by my colleague here. But maybe in some kind of a context, because this is a horrible time to try to sell bonds.
Well, actually, we're in the market this morning. I should be on a pricing call. And we did pretty well through the chair, Representative Gilliam. Interest rates are stabilizing in the municipal bond market. So for better or for worse, we had a terrible fall. And we put our toes in the water this past week to price the COPs. We were already going to be selling certificates of participation. We added what was approved by the legislature to that. And I had over $125 million in orders from retail customers yesterday. And if I could be on the call right now, I'd find out how the institutional side did. But let me step back. And my Bonding 101 class, just real briefly, there's this notion of pay-as-you-go, which is you save money, and when you have enough money, you buy something, and then there's called pay-as-you-use. And I think what's tricky and challenging for forest purchases versus perhaps financing of a university campus is that you understand that you don't have enough money. You couldn't save enough money in a budget to buy it all at once, your new building. And so generally we sell bonds, and I'll use a dormitory as an example. We issue the bonds. It's got a long-term payment. But the people who live in the dorm every year are paying fees, and that's help covering the cost. It's similar to a mortgage. What I think makes revenue streams for forests more difficult is there's a long payback. If you bought a forest that it was in its prime and you were harvesting it annually, you would have revenue streams, and that would make it pretty straightforward, right? I mean, that's a typical decision you'd make in the private business. The challenge here is that you have a forest that's not going to be generating revenues for a number of years. And so, as the vice chair pointed out, you're going to need to find some other source of revenue, or else you're going to need the general fund, in all honesty, to cover the debt service in those years until this forest is back ready to be harvested, and then it can support itself. And that's why I'm particularly keen that whatever solution, and I don't have a perspective whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, but my job as a technician is to tell you, if you decide you want to do it, if you think it's a good idea, you need to make sure that we have a revenue stream that pays that debt service in year one, two, three, all the way out through the life of those bonds.
Okay. Representative Shoffa, then we'll come.
Thank you. And even though my friend here and I voted differently, I believe this investment is a far better and valuable, far more better and valuable investment than some of the things we invested in last week. I think that you could make that argument. Not all of them, but some of them. So you've already heard that the intention here is to keep this a working forest and harvest wood fiber products. So then why not say right in there, our intention here is to manage this forest to the greatest wood fiber production possible, sustainable wood fiber products. Why not do something like that rather than the definition you're using? Because the definition you're using is open to interpretation, the greatest value. Doesn't say anything about wood fiber production. It's the greatest value could be skipping through there with your basket picking wildflowers. You know, and you know what? That's not, to me, that's not the greatest value. I think the greatest value here, especially when you talk about the generation of revenue to provide the services in this state that we can't provide right now because we painted ourselves in a corner, I think it should something along the lines of saying the greatest sustainable, I'll give you that one because I want to sustain this resource too. And I know men and women who work in the forest and feed their families have been for generations doing that. The greatest sustainable wood fiber production value. I think that's what it should say because then it's clear what we want to do. Or something similar.
So I'm going to go to my left, Representative Winger here in a moment.
Not probably to your left.
Yeah. I would, you know, this bill, obviously there's no work session. I would encourage you, if you want that to be a successful activity when we have one, to continue working with my friend, friends over here regarding amendments. Representative Winger, way out to my left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Laura, I thank you for your valiant attempts to explain to Representative Gilliam bonding, but he's not qualified for bonding 101. He would have to start at 050 and try to eventually qualify
Chair,
for bonding.
What happened today?
You came late, and so I let him at you.
I want to get at this. You talk about the counties wanting to be held whole from the loss of the property tax that they're currently receiving. But this land does not generate much, if any, revenue up front. So help me understand that. How much is the county losing in property tax, and exactly where would the money be coming from to keep them whole, and over how long a period of time?
Sure. Chair Clem and Representative Wingard, The short answer is it would come from revenues that we generate on other state forests. And this is all part of the budget decision that we've got to work through yet. Over the past several years, we've generated, between the Common School Fund and the state forest lands, we've generated about $100 million a year on timber sales. We retain about 36% of that. We use about 35 of that, and it's built up a little money here and there. And when we were looking at this purchase a year or so ago, forest industry wasn't in the straits it's in right now, and our revenue cash flow was looking pretty good. It looks more challenged right now. And we may, in the end, not be able to recommend in our budget appropriation that we pursue the purchase of this if we don't feel like, you know, the revenue we can generate from all of our state forests in total could cover the expenses that we would expect to incur on this property. And the expenses we would expect to incur on this property are paying off the bond, paying the property tax, which on the entire property right now is about $90,000 per year. So if we may or may not buy all of it. If we didn't buy all of it, it would only be a portion of that. The fire protection bill is about $150,000 a year. And because it becomes state ownership, that doubles. There is no general fund contributed to the protection of state forests, so that is about $300,000 a year in expenses. We think, you know, right now we could probably get by with only adding about one staff person to this, because it's mainly going to be keeping an eye on forest health, implementing some thinnings where we need to. It's going to be pretty low touch until the forest gets back to some level of harvestability. The one opportunity for revenue that actually we're exploring here, I've got a meeting tomorrow with a biomass company that's very interested in this property and its ability to provide a supply to a facility that they're thinking about. And so we could be looking at, instead of pre-commercial thinning, some value from thinning. So, yeah, there's a, you know, the balance sheet on this is definitely of concern, and we're not going to recommend it. The purchase, unless we feel like it'll work within, you know, our revenue stream.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wingard. Am I pronouncing it right?
It's Wingard.
Wingard, not Wingard. Your staff educated me a little bit on that, and I'm trying.
My departed grandmother will haunt you for mispronouncing it. I'm wondering why it isn't possible, and when you met with me yesterday, you were talking about harvest levels and income generation much, much higher than this, at a point at which this forest is at full capacity or maximum yield or whatever term you want to use. Why couldn't you do enough work in the forest, whether it's thinning or harvesting or biomass, to produce at a minimum the $90,000 a year that the county is losing in property taxes?
Chair Clement, Representative Wingard, there will be some volume coming off of that in the form of saw logs, and it will offset some of that cost. Don't quote me on this. I'm thinking that our early cruises said we might be able to harvest about 1 million feet a year on 125,000 acres. Is that
about half of that?
About half of that. So there's some value there. You know, if that were if it were 1 million feet and you were getting, somebody says don't do math in public. You're getting $150 a thousand. I think that's $150,000 of revenue if you were harvesting 1 million feet a year.
Representative Wingard.
Just want to, thank you, Mr. Chair, follow on some of my colleagues' points here. Over half the land in this state is already controlled by the government. And I don't believe that any assurance, and this is nothing personal because essentially you two gentlemen will not be here when and if this forest heads in a different direction and promises and statements are not delivered on. So to my colleague down the row here, I would submit that no statement really is worth anything in the long run, because I think we have seen in the past that these kinds of statements and promises and community expectations just simply are not delivered on. And I am interested, because originally I was going to say that there probably is no circumstance under which I would support this, because I just no longer trust the state government to keep faith with rural communities and to deliver what they promise on these kinds of things. And I just can't imagine delivering more acreage in this state from private into public hands. However, I at least will remain open to the idea that if this bill is crafted a way in which there is language in the bill that makes it clear what this forest is intended to do in a way that is superior to what currently controls in places like the Elliott and Tillamook and others, then I remain open to the possibility of voting for this bill. But I think when you suggested that you had originally pursued something that people had trouble with, I'd be looking for a bill that some people have trouble with, because that would be some assurance to me that this bill and that some of the statements that you all, I think, want to make in good faith can actually be delivered on. And I'll leave it at that.
Chair Quinn, may I respond?
Great, please. And then we've got six members of the public and then a whole other topic. And we're not voting. We'll hear this again. We'll have all these conversations again. Please.
Thank you. I understand the frustrations about the certainty of land use management. I read Tim Josie's article this morning also, and rather than being offended by it, I sympathized to a certain degree with his frustrations, because regardless of one's land management philosophy, one should expect some degree of certainty. And I think Tim Josie is simply frustrated beyond measure that he hasn't had certainty and can't seem to discover certainty. So I took no offense. My interest in the Gilchrist property, having watched it for 40 years, a beautiful piece of forested property, the Gilchrist started buying that land in the early 1900s, harvested off of it for nearly 80 years. When it was sold, it had more standing volume than when they acquired it. And they built a great community and great lives off of that land. What we see happening now, unless we keep it in productive forest land, we're going to see it subdivided into recreational property, and the certainty there is it'll never produce trees again. Not sure I'd like to prevent that.
Representative Roblin, and then I'll. Are you going to require a response or not?
Yeah, well, just two quick.
Okay, yes, things. Please. Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first one is, as I read this bill, and I understand that it really has to do with the Gilchrist property, but it looks as if it is a bill that gives general guidelines in any purchase, not just the Gilchrist property. Am I correct in that assumption?
Correct.
So you brought it because there is this possibility, but if we put this into place, it actually sets forward in the future how any purchase would go forward. Correct. So it has a bigger purpose than just the Gilchrist property. Number two, I guess as you start considering language or conversations that have just gone about, I think there are some ways to craft some language. If this real intention about this forest is to have a sustainable harvest over a long period of time, to look at what those responsible industry leaders are doing in their forests and tie it to some of whatever the best practice is in the industry. I mean, we do a lot of best practices up here in our legislative work. And I think that there's a way to craft language that says, in areas such as this, we should be looking at best practice in the industry. Now, I think it's best practice because there are, as we know, these groups that have gone in and just slashed and left. But there are companies who want to be here for the long term, and they have shown over many, many generations that their intention is to have, as the Gilchrist family did, actually more standing timber all the time. It wasn't the intention to just take it out. It was to manage that in such a way. And there are best practices out there in industry. And if we are truly looking at production as the forest deal, then let's talk about that with people and talk about a best practices scenario for the harvest of those lands, apart from the conversations that we've had about greatest permanent value. So to me, those are the kinds of places where we can actually find maybe some of that compromise. So that's just a statement.
Great. We have 6 members of the public to testify on this. Can we ask them if it comes up or they don't answer it? Thank you all.
Thank you.
Let me call up because I want to talk about our Willamette Bio, our Energy Park, which is our next project. But can I get up all at once, Bill Cluding, Bob Van Dyke, and Ray Wilkerson? After that's going to be David Moskowitz, Katie Fast, and Stephen Kefouri. And that will be done. Bill, you're up first. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Committee, for the record, my name is Bill Pudding, Carpenters Industrial Council. I understand the frustration from the committee, especially what we're going through with the Elliott. Somehow the Oregon Land Board has to be aware of how critical following the Constitution of 1859 to get the proper harvest level up to help our schools. But again, I represent thousands of members in this state, and every one of them depends on timber harvest. And just white, we cannot afford to lose one more acre of timberland. And if the Oregon Department of Forestry can work it to where they can acquire these tracts of land using the Oregon Forest Practices Act, my members are 100% behind this. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Chair Clem, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Bob Van Dyke, and I work for the Wild Salmon Center. I'm pleased to speak in support of 2216. A couple quick comments. One is I hope that the discussion about the specific purchase on the Gilchrist can be separated from this bill, and that I think this bill cleans up the acquisition authority, which is something that needs to be done separate from the Gilchrist specific purchase. The second thing I'd like to say is that with regard to the Gilchrist purchase in particular, it seems to me the choice we're facing there is between conversion and continuation as forest land. So while I understand some of your concerns about mandating a certain forest approach on the lands, I'm afraid at some level the choice may be between not being in the forest management base at all. So I just suggest that you'd keep that in mind going forward. I guess I'd lastly like to say that from my view, we simply can't always rely on private financial interests, private corporate interests, to take care and look to the long term for lands in the state. And I think that's what we see on the Gilchrist parcel. You know, it's dramatically cut over now. If it had been managed differently, still to make a profit, but not as much a short-term profit, it'd be in much better shape right now. So just something to bear in mind there. I think the comments that Representative Roblin made about thinking about best management practices or somehow mandating a longer view toward the lands, even if it's timber-focused, would be desirable. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council. Real quick, I checked neutral on the sign-up sheet because we think there are pros and cons to this approach. The pros, clearly, if the goal could be achieved of keeping working forests as working forests and preventing fragmentation and maintaining the forest products manufacturing infrastructure, that's a very worthy goal. And if that could be achieved, that would be worth your serious consideration. The other thing I'd say is that Mr. Blackwell mentioned the Sun Pass State Forest next to Klamath Falls, and I've toured that forest, and I would agree with him that it is a model of how Eastside Forest should be managed, and it's a beautiful forest, and the counties get revenue off of it, so the state of Oregon, through that experience, has demonstrated their ability to have a state forest in that part of the world and do it the right way. So those are the good things. The bad things have already been mentioned before the committee. There's a skepticism. We would share Representative Wingert's skepticism about, you know, the difficulties of keeping politics out of this and the pressures to try to be all things to all people, which drives down the outputs from forests. And we've seen that in spades, unfortunately, on the west side forest, the Tillamook and the Clatsop and the Elliott. If those three forests were privately owned, managed under the Forest Practices Act, the timber production would be roughly double what it is under state management. And a recent study that the Department of Forestry did on what they call return on asset value on the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest indicated the current return on asset value is 1.6%, which if that was privately owned, private people who purchase private forest land expect and anticipate and generally receive a return on asset value of 5 to 6%. So that just demonstrates how much value is not being realized to the detriment, in one case, of the common school fund and in the other case of the trust land counties. So that's the reason we checked neutral, because of that skepticism. If that happens, if that was to happen on the Gilchrist track, then it wouldn't be worth it. One final comment. This is just an editorial. Share Mr. Blackwell's recollection of the history of these lands. The Gilchrist Timber Company was a charter member of OFIC when we first started up, and Frank Gilchrist was one of the original members of the board of directors, and it was a wonderfully managed company. And if the state of Oregon could return these lands to that kind of management someday, it would be a great thing. But we are skeptical given the politics that surround the state forest issue right now. So thank you.
So let me ask a question, if any of you know this. We had conversation in our land use committee that Representative Winger and I sit on regarding sort of the, forget the term, but Matthew Donegan talked essentially about the market value for development versus sitting on it. They are always watching the spread grow between conversion, essentially. What are the minimum acreages to just buy a house and have a current law in this 95,000 acres? Is it 160 acres and you can have your house?
Mr. Chair, I believe it is 160. It's either 160 or 240, and maybe there's, depending on circumstances, on the east side. It's smaller on the west side.
So it would be currently legal to divide 95,000 by the minimum acres and see how many people would want to buy a house with that many acres and live on it, which was our very first meeting we had for about strengths, weaknesses, threats, and opportunities that the state forester talked about, which is there are people who will do that. They'll buy it, buy a house, sit on their 160 acres, and do nothing but enjoy it. And that's all legal currently.
I believe that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And Representative Roblin.
Yeah, and a comment on to that one, too. And it also reduces access for hunting and other kind of activities when they do so.
And if I may add one thing briefly, there are also oftentimes dramatic fire problems that come with that kind of subdivision, a lot more danger, a lot more difficult to control fire.
Okay, any questions for this panel? Great, let's get our next panel up.
Thank you.
I'll note, I met a gentleman along the Umpqua River who was very proud to tell me that he had purchased 160 plus acres up on the hillside behind him, and he had moved here recently from California and bought it. It was never going to be touched at all. And I wasn't happy about that, but he was really happy about that, and he could afford it. So we bought all the timber behind him up in the mountain and put a house down and wasn't going to do anything with it at all, and was quite pleased. Representative Shaw.
Well, when it grows into a thicket and burns his California mansion down, he'll wish he'd done something with it.
I used telepathy to send that to him. I didn't say that out loud because I think he was near his guns and other things too. And I was near his property line.
Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me. We need to make sure his acronym, what it was about, skipping through the forest with a basket. I'd love to see him in a forest with a basket.
If we
can arrange that, Representative.
A reenactment of that with a signy die tape.
See it happening anytime.
Yes. Yeah. That's a signy die tape reenactment.
There we go.
Whoever had one. Welcome. I've got David, then Katie, then Stephen.
Thank you, Chair Klem, members of the committee. David Moskowitz here today, and I checked neutral on the box here as well. However, there's definitely support for the concept behind this bill. The goal of sustaining or helping with county revenues, keeping work in forest, those are commendable goals. I want to also say, though, because there's been a bit of a mention about the greatest permanent value rule, that my clients support that rule, and we think it's an important rule to manage the state-owned forest in Oregon for a whole lot of people and for a whole lot of reasons, including skipping through the forest with a basket. Whether you're collecting mushrooms or ferns, if we can collect on these things, they can all add value to the state. Working forest is not just trees that are then cut down. It does produce lumber. Working forest produces fiber, and it can produce biomass, carbon storage, clean water, recreation, fish and wildlife, and the skipping through the forest as well. Those are all parts of a working forest. I think it's important to think about why we have these are private lands now, and why is there not a private timber company or forest products company that's jumping in to buy this? And one of the things is that it's very hard to make money on the east side. The east side forests are a lot different than the west side forests in terms of their growth and volume, and I think we need to be careful about this, and we definitely support Representative Roblin's caution that this bill should be thought of more broadly and not just focused on that particular acquisition. To that end, there is an issue on the bill on page 1 near the bottom in subsection 4, starting with line 25, and it talks about the board is given authority to sell lands or partial interests, and on line 27, where it says, if the sale is otherwise in the best interest of Oregonians. I couldn't find that defined anywhere in statute. It gives us some concern about what that means. We think there needs to be clarification about that, about what that threshold test is. It sounds like there's going to be work on this bill. We'd like to be involved with it. We would like to see it succeed because the Department of Forestry, we think that they are doing a fair job on their lands. And just one last point, we've talked about Commissioner Josie, former representative, feeling like he doesn't have any certainty. And I just want to make note of the timber harvest levels that have come off the Tillamook-Clatsop. In 1995, there was 80 million board feet. In 2000, there was 160 million board feet. 2005 and 2006, it was upwards of 220 to 225 million board feet. That's an increasing level. The volumes just recently are lower for a number of different reasons. But we have seen increasing levels of harvest on that land, and it's still producing, just to a large degree, all those other forest values. So we think that's a sign the state can manage these lands for values for all Oregonians. So we support this. We hope to work with the department and move it forward. Thank you.
You want to wait or do it now?
I'd like to do one.
Sure,
right.
What's that?
I would right now. If I
yeah, Representative Roblin.
Thank you very much. And I guess my only question is, and I appreciate the comment about the Tillamook, and that's the question I had. I mean, if you look at those, there were some budget notes that were attached to the forestry department with regard to forest production in the Tillamook during those same times that it went up. And I just want to make sure that clearly, I agree with you, the productions went up and the values stayed the same. We still had a forest that was healthy and working well. We haven't had those budget notes. It's gone back down. So are you saying that there is more room in the Tillamook for harvest and to maintain those values?
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, on the Tillamook, The Department of Forestry has done extensive volume. They've tried to assess the volumes on that forest. And I think that what has been discovered is that there's a lot fewer trees on that landscape, and they're growing a lot slower. And Swiss needle cast is one reason for that. So the department's own work is showing that there may not be as many trees there to enable forestry to get to those levels that the counties originally were promised based on some flawed modeling that happened as the plan was developed from 1998 through 2000. And you know, they'll always talk about a number of 279 million board feet, while industry will say that's still less than is growing, still less than we can harvest under forest practices rules, rules that we believe don't protect water quality and don't protect fish. The state forest plan and the riparian standards there are things we support. We support how the forest is being managed now. The decline in board feet that has actually been harvested, there's been some severe windstorms. There's been a number of storms. There's been problems with infrastructure due to flooding, and the markets have also changed. So there's a whole lot of reasons. I'm not an expert on that. I think that Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest can produce in the range, and this is just my personal opinion, in the range of 180 to 200 million board feet a year. And I think that's quite a bit more than Commissioner Josie saw in 1995.
So we're going to have lots more conversation, I can assure you, about the Tillamook, about the term greatest permanent value, about the role of the legislature vis-a-vis the Board of Forestry. So let's try and just get through this so we can, we'll be hearing this one again, too. But I want to talk about our bioenergy park badly. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Klim and members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fass with Oregon Farm Bureau, and I'll try to be brief. The Oregon Farm Bureau does have concerns with 2216. This is a large policy discussion for the state. Giving the Department of Forestry authority to bond at an unlimited number to bring new lands under state ownership and management. At the same time, accruing a large amount of financial debt is a concern to my members. And that's looking at the situation in the general form of the bill. Looking at this sale in particular, do have concerns. One, right now we do not have a value on the price that we're looking at. Two, if you go with the revenue bond scenario where state timber harvest receipts will be repaying back that bond, we question the impacts that that's going to have under the repayment schedule or the schedule of payments to counties under the Tillamook and Clatsop store forests. So is that going to mean at the first part of the bond sale when the Gilcrest property is not under full production level because it has been harvested heavily recently, does that mean less revenue to Tillamook and Clatsop counties due to having to repay the debt first out of the Department of Forestry's budget? If you go with a general obligation bond, that means the general fund will be paying that debt first, if maybe I understand bonding 101. So when we're looking at an agency where other programs are being pushed on to landowners and moved away from the general fund, we have concerns with adding debt to the agency. Will more of the department's services and structure be put on to landowners to pay for that debt? I think I would also raise that, you know, we looked at nearly $500,000 in operating costs on just property taxes and fire suppression, not including management, when they ran through kind of the financials on the property. And I would say I don't think you can take politics out of state land management. We've seen discussions just this morning on disagreements on how the Tillamook, Clatsop, and Elliott are managed. This adds another property of conflict and disagreement. So if it does move forward, we would like to see some guarantees that the property is managed as a working forest. I'd also like to add that 160 acres can be managed as a working forest and get timber harvest off that, and the small woodland owners of the state would like you to remember that. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Stephen. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm here this morning representing the Trust for Public Land. Trust for Public Land is the largest land trust in the United States, and we operate here in Oregon. I work for the Oregon office. What we do is operate as a middle person between willing sellers and willing buyers, taking land that would otherwise be threatened with development and purchasing it and then selling it to local state governments, federal government, whoever wants to manage that land. Our motto is land for people, and we don't we do a lot of parks. We do a lot of facilities that are for public use. The last few years, we've been approached a lot by owners of timberland. What's happening is that where it used to be timber companies owning these lands, now property owners, insurance companies, for example, people who are interested in making money rather than on the value of the land, selling it, not on the land as long-term timber production. And they're coming to us and saying, we have X number of acres here, X number of acres here. Would you like to buy it and then sell it to somebody else who would keep it in as a working forest? And we're in the process of doing that. The problem of not doing that is that, as you've heard this morning, you have inholdings, and that makes a lot of difficulties for land use. One of the big things happens with fire suppression. If you have 150,000 acres, in the middle of that somebody's got a house and there's a fire, what happens? The first thing is your fire trucks and your staff all go to protect that house. And that may or may not be the best way to protect that whole piece of property from fire. The fire just, and it's also fire hazards. A lot of the fires that occur in those areas are caused by people who live in those areas. There are also all kinds of other land use problems, the difficulty of providing services to those people who want to have ambulance service, they're going to have fire service, they want to have telephone service, they want to have water service, and it all costs the public. We think it's a better thing for the public to preserve working forests and the jobs that are either there or potentially there. Right now on this land, Gilcrest, obviously there's not a lot of jobs because there's not a lot of trees left, but there could be. We have successfully saved other forests in the state as working forests, and we are looking at this bill. We're not interested particularly in the Gilcrest property. It's not one that we've been particularly involved with, but there are other similar properties to that that we are involved with. We think that this bill provides a broad-scale tool, another tool. It's not going to be the answer. We're not going to be able to buy all the timberlands in the state to preserve them. But purchase of land, purchase of easements, and lurking with our land use plans are some means that we can use to help preserve our forests, our working jobs. And we would hope that you continue in that vein and pass this bill. Thank you.
Questions? Ooh, thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. I'm going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2216. Mr. State Forester, I think you know sort of who you got to talk to and about what.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks.
Appreciate
your time. Thanks. Let me call up my friends from the Willamette Valley Bioenergy Park Project, Dave Nelson, Larry Bryce. Let's get four up here if we can. Roger Beyer and Michael McKenzie Barr. You'll like this one, committee.
I will.
You will.
Okay, good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson, retired executive secretary of the Oregon Seed Council, and also not to take you back to the last bill, but I'm probably the only kid in the building that played basketball at Gilcrest. So when I was a student in high school at Paisley, so we'd play Crane and Lapine and Gilcrest and those kind of places. But anyway.
Did you dominate them?
We did, yes.
Nice.
But when we got to Merrill and those at Lakeview, they killed us.
I wonder if they could pass off the wall at Gilcrest. Could
the
you
what?
Pass off the wall at Gilcrest? I mean, there were some of those old gyms where you passed off the wall.
Yeah, right. Like,
if Gilcrest was one of those.
Yeah, right. The Lapine wall was just a foot and a half beyond the end line.
It was like Langlois. Okay, sorry. Bio Willamette Energy Park Project.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this project really arose out of the continuing search for alternatives. So what do you do with a million tons of grass seed? Yeah, they've got it. grass seed straw here in the Willamette Valley. As you know, the Willamette Valley and the state of Oregon is the dominant grass seed producer in the world. Field burning has been an ongoing controversy for the last 40 years of my career, and I've made a career out of field burning. But anyway, this project really arose out of meetings that we had with Tulane County commissioners standing out in some growers' fields, kicking clods and looking at the production and talking about how we could make progress in further reducing the amount of field burning that was taking place in the southern end of the Willamette Valley, which particularly annual ryegrass production. And generally, we agreed that a market-driven solution was probably the most practical and delivered the best benefits to everybody concerned in the process, and that it maintained the economic value of grass seed production in the region, reduced open field burning or gave the opportunity to do that, resulted in increased renewable energy production and brought about greater employment in the Willamette Valley. So we both, the Lane County Board of Commissioners and the Oregon Seed Council in November 2007, passed identical resolutions to fund this project, a feasibility study to look at the practicality of generating electricity or generating other kinds of energy using grass seed straw and other agricultural waste. We went through several steps beyond that. Chair Roblin of the Interim Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources asked for the committee to hear the project in June of last year. Chair Clem sat on that committee, as a couple of others of you did. And the committee asked us asked the Department of Agriculture to request $350,000 from the Emergency Board to go to the next step, which was funding a business plan that would describe completely how this project would in fact work, and that we could go to the capital markets and look at building a pilot project and getting it on the ground. The E-Board at that time decided that just between June and then, the economy began tipping over, and the E-Board decided that they supported the program without exception. However, no money was forthcoming, so the Department of Agriculture was told to start to tell us and to work with us to start cobbling together resources, money for developing the business plan. So where we are today, and you'll hear this later in the project, we've put together about $250,000 of the $350,000, and Chair Clem has requested introduction of a bill to hopefully you'll get and send down to Ways and Means for an additional $100,000 to finish that off, to give us access to the capital markets. So today we're going to present you the business plan or the feasibility study, the cost and power productions expectations, and the funding plan for development of this kind of a facility. I'd like to introduce in the far end Michael McKenzie Barr, who is the Lane County Economic and Community Development Officer, Larry Bryce from the Novus Group. They're basically project managers and developers from Eugene. Roger Beyer is my successor at the Seed Council. And with that, why don't we get right to the project, and you can take a look at it.
Chair and Representatives, thanks for having us here. I'm not sure if I'm going to get this projector working, so we will start. You've got first part. We've got three documents for you, and I'm not going to spend time going
Michael,
through
Michael, would
them
you
all.
Just identify yourself?
So sure. Mike McKenzie Barr, Lane County Community and Economic Development Coordinator.
Thank you.
I am the project lead on the feasibility study. At Lane County, we have been working on three renewable energy feasibility studies, all based around waste products. To undertake that, we put together a team, kind of cross-section across the Willamette Valley, of educational folks, of government folks, of nonprofits, and private companies. And we basically went through a request for proposal process, request for qualifications, over the past about a year and a half ago. And
power there.
Anyway, so we on the first page, you can see the energy feasibility studies. We looked at woody biomass, we're looking at food waste, and, of course, the grass straw project. The idea with the, I'm going to kind of skip by the woody biomass, skip by the food waste. You've got some of the information there for you on the second page. Starts the ryegrass straw to energy project goals. Basically, determine the economic value of ryegrass as an energy feedstock product. Now you got it in big type too, instead of this just the little type that I handed out. The cord going all over. The kind of want to address the economic viability of grass straw for conversion to bioenergy. What does that look like from an economic standpoint? This needs to stand alone. It really needs to stand alone. And also address that value as a straw to energy compared to nutrients from burning. You know, we've had a chance to really work with the growers, and we were surprised, like other people from Eugene, you know, they don't just get up and say, hey, I want to burn something up. You know, there's really actually a purpose to this burning. You know, they want to put some nutrients back into the soil. They want to do some pest control. So what is the value of those things also compared to renewable energy? And then also look at the best locations for processing facilities, someplace to convert this into renewable energy. So kind of the what we think the project can lead to is an economic value to the growers, decrease in burning of annual ryegrass straw, creation of local renewable energy, and then a comprehensive valley-wide solution for agricultural waste. Study has been going on for a year. We have wrapped up the study, the feasibility study elements were collection, transportation, nutrient replacement. Basically look at the economic values across the value chain for the straw. Then to look at some specific conversion technologies that have been used in other places to take agricultural waste to renewable energy, to actually do tests. So we took local annual ryegrass straw, sent it to national labs in the U.S. and in Europe, and went through processes, all the processes you see here, to take a look at, you know, how much energy is it, what is the cost to take that energy out of that straw. We went through an entire facility siting elements. I'll walk you through a little bit of how we did that. Financial models for each of the types of facilities. If you had X amount of straw, it's going to cost you how much for capital X, how much for operations, how much for transportation, and so on. And then findings, recommendations, and next steps, which we're also going to present to you today. I'm going to go by some of this stuff, but basically economic values on all of it. We have filled up basically two binders that look like this. Although the other ones that I carry are the ones on my desk are neater than the ones that I carry. I should say it that way. Lots of time, lots of energy, and we believe we've got down to a very minute level on pretty much every piece of thing that we have studied. The conversion technologies basically looked at what is the yield per ton of the energy balance for all of these conversions. On the sites, we started with delineating on this left-hand top map where the annual ryegrass straw is grown. Began to take a look at underutilized industrial sites, basically folks that weren't through the property tax rules, that weren't paying their full property tax, you know, if it was a developed site. Then began to drill down on specific sites. As you see on the right-hand side, we've got many maps where we've got kind of aerial looks, and then we took tours of the sites, and then down to, on the left-hand side, specific wetland delineations that had already been incurred for the site, collected lots of information on the sites, did financial models. This is just a pullout of one of the financial models, basically looked at all the component CapEx costs, look at what the operation and management costs would be for each of the pieces of capital expenditures, looked at the revenue for each of those. All the financial models have been brought together into one overarching financial summary of what we kind of found, that the conversion technology of anaerobic digestion has an immediate potential to produce net revenues from the conversion of annual ryegrass straw. I usually have a whole section about all these technologies. I kind of pulled it out, but basically, if everybody's familiar with anaerobic digestion, it's traditionally used in America on dairies or at solid waste municipal sites to treat manures. In Europe, it is
And that's the only place it's used really in America. In Europe, it's used to treat all kinds of what have been classified as wastes, but are now, of course, a renewable energy feedstocks. It is an organic process. What we found in the study, though, was that just treating grass straw by itself is low on energy. Took a look at some opportunities from other reports, other studies that folks were doing, and began to, in some of our tests, mix other things in that anaerobic digester through these tests. For instance, taking food waste, if you had 100% of grass straw, we substitute, we add 15% food waste, we double the methane, which basically doubles the electricity production just by changing out 15%. That then allowed us, we actually got some additional funding from Energy Trust of Oregon to try some other mixed feedstocks. That process is currently going on. It'll be wrapped up in about a month. We're trying six other feedstocks that are in the Willamette Valley. Basically, we're just focused on what were traditionally waste products. These are problem products that folks are trying to get rid of. We are not looking at any food to waste or food to energy. We're not looking at replacing any crops in the valley, growing other crops to energy. We're just looking at really waste products and then, again, focused around the straw. We saw in our study that cellulosic ethanol has a midterm potential to produce net revenues, and really none of the other conversion processes have a current local market for the energy they produce or for the product, but there are other efforts underway with some of our other partners to develop such markets. So on the siting side, not me, looking at the amount of waste and realize as we were doing the siting and doing the maps, we could actually be talking about three projects, not one project with the amount of waste and with the transportation costs. So in the business plan, in our summary findings, which then led to the business plan, narrowed down to a specific industrial site in Lane County, Junction City, in Linn County, Millersburg, in Benton County, Corvallis. And the reasons for these three sites, which are actually all municipal-owned, we did look at some private property sites, but the municipal-owned sites provided numerous advantages, basically some opportunities for public-private partnerships in conjunction with some government funding. The sites met all the project established criteria. In addition, those sites were already had their wetland delineations done. Some of the permitting was already done for other projects that would potentially go on those sites, so we could speed up this process so as field burning is phased down, we need to find something fairly quickly to be able to do here. So the working group recommendations, initiate a pilot project using grass straw as a bioenergy source. Work with some other renewable energy projects to involve grass straw as an energy substrata. There's some anaerobic digesters at dairies. Those folks are now testing some grass to go with those, seeing some opportunities there. And then develop a bioenergy park where local and regional agricultural and municipal organic waste can be processed through a variety of integrated conversion technologies to produce high-value, clean, renewable energy, biofuels, and green bioproducts. Looking at parks that are right size for the community, basically not importing a bunch of waste, take a look at a 25-mile, maybe 50 miles or 40 miles around those sites. What are the waste products that people are trying to dispose of? How could we use them? Which kind of gets us to the business plan part. This is just a project of a bioenergy park in Denmark. To give you a scale, that building right in the dead center, that long rectangle is about 75,000 square feet. The round tanks stand about 24 feet tall. They're about 84 feet around. They're in the far right-hand side of the picture. Using some of what Europe's doing as a model, take a look at on the park.
Yeah, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. On the plant you just showed, how many acres of grass seed production can the straw that results from that, can that plant right there handle?
Sure. That one could handle 50,000 tons.
15?
50.
50.
50. Yeah. So what we're is
you figure about 2.5 tons of straw per acre. So you're talking about 25,000 acres or 20,000 acres, something like that. We've got about 140,000 acres in grass, in annual ryegrass in the South Valley.
Thank you. Again, how we came up with three. And you'll see as we move forward that we're talking about a phased-in approach. To take a look at basically in the purple, the technologies on one site, to look at cellulosic ethanol, biogas facility, that's the anaerobic digester, biodiesel, pellet mill, again, mixing wastes. You'll see in your sheets, a nice chart for perusing later
basically in the cellular, in this bioenergy park, to use the wastes also that come out of each conversion process as an input into the other processes. So anaerobic digestion biogas produces a tremendous amount of heat. The issue, one of the issues with the cost of cellulosic ethanol is the amount of heat that's required to produce cellulosic ethanol. We have excess heat in the anaerobic digester that could just be flipped right over into the cellulosic ethanol. Same thing with pellets. The waste product, one of the waste products out of cellulosic ethanol and biodiesel are both perfect to go into an anaerobic digestion facility to increase methane production and increase electricity. The Bioenergy Park is a model to look at a biogas plant that would produce 3 megawatts to 5 megawatts of electricity. Potentially in the future, renewable natural gas, we're going to see, hopefully in 2009, a state standard for renewable natural gas into the pipeline. There is not such a standard at this particular moment. They're moving forward on such a standard. From the biogas plant, you'd also have, again, co-generated heat sold to nearby businesses. Greenhouses, for instance, are used on site. Composters that could go back to the growers. What's really interesting about waste and pulling the energy out of waste, you're still left with almost the exact same amount of waste as you put in. What you've got it in a slightly different form, and you've pulled the energy out. So if you're putting in 50,000 tons of grass straw, we're basically pulling out 50,000 tons of compost and fibers and nitrogen on the back end. But we've pulled the energy out of it. Cellulosic ethanol, starting with a pilot plant of about 200,000 gallons a year, biodiesel of about 2 million gallons, pellets of pilot of about 10 tons per year. How much? Such a plant using all in, this number is all in, about $20 million. And you can see it includes your permitting, engineering, your property developments, your capital expenditure costs, your construction costs, and so on. So where does money come from? Using the Betsy on $20 million, about a $6.6 million tax credit sale. Again, that's a pass-through to somebody else rather than keeping it for the project so that you have funds for the project. About $7 to $10 million on the government loan through the State Energy Loan Program. The stimulus package as it looks right now has $8 billion in the USDA RD4 loan guarantees for these types of programs. So an opportunity there. Leaves about a $3.5 million to $6.5 million balance. What's interesting is the stimulus package, as it looks now, has a federal tax credit that looks exactly like the Betsy. So there's an opportunity there for a tax sale, again, to possibly take another $3 to $6 million. At that point, we're basically there with the facility. So, but what do we need to get these funds? One of the things is that you need a business plan, and we've actually, we're calling it a business plan, but we've sort of gone beyond the business plan stage. In our business plan, and Larry's going to talk a little bit about some of these specific elements of this plan, we're also delivering with the business plan all of the filled out permits that are needed for a site. So this project, as you'll see, has been adopted by the governor's economic revitalization team, so we have match from state lands, from DEQ, from ODOT to assist us with these permits that are needed for a site. We have basically all of the financing packages, because even for the State Energy Loan Program, so you're going to see what we've done through the business plan is adopted their criteria that they require in order to get a business loan. So they have reams of material that they require. That's what will be developed within the business plan. Feasibility study asked, hey, is this possible? Is there a benefit to the growers? And the feasibility study, we've said yes. And we think there's multiple opportunities. Now let's get this down so that we've got a plan that somebody can use on a site to immediately develop that site. Timeline that we're in now, final report is going to be released this month. The project business plan is already underway. As Dave mentioned, we have funding from the Department of Agriculture and others. We are working on securing funding for the project, as Larry will talk about. It's met with at least 18 different funding organizations. Again, though, the amount of data that's needed, and especially in today's capital markets where people have gotten just scared to invest money even in good projects, need additional information. And we'd love to break ground 6-2009, and that break ground is basically turn a shovel. We would like to be operation by the end of construction season 2010. However, if we want to go after stimulus package money, which we are working on,
you know, basically 120 days shovel ready, et cetera. So we need to be in a place to be able to do that. And turn it over to Larry. I'll take questions whenever you'd like us to take questions. But Larry, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the business plan elements and why these elements.
Representative Schaffler's got one before we go any further.
Now I know why you wanted to get to this, Mr. Chair. This is great stuff. I wish the self-appointed protectors of the environment were in here and those proponents of green energy were in here.
We have been working a lot with them.
Good. God bless you. I have no idea how much this, you know, energy unit would be less carbon, all that stuff. That's something, you know, you need to answer this question now, but gosh darn it, now I lost my train of thought, but go ahead. I'll remember my question here in a moment. I'm ready to vote right now.
I know what it was. My bill's not even back for that.
I know what it was, Mr. Chair. Is this going to be publicly traded? How is this working?
That would depend on whatever ownership structure you had. I think you might be thinking publicly traded with respect to carbon credits.
No.
Stock ownership.
Invest stocks. Sure. Things
That's part of what will determine in this business plan is what is going to be the ownership structure, because there's some elements. Let me give you a case in point.
Do I need
point.
To have him identify himself first?
One would be that...
Larry, I need to have you identify yourself because it's the first time you're getting to talk.
Representative Clem, members of the committee, I'm Larry Bryce with the Novus Group. I've been working on this project since its inception, trying to look at the economic metrics on it. But one of the cases in point on the structure is that one of the key elements, if you're going to be an investor, what do investors want to do? Like all of us, they want to mitigate risk. They want to look through every element in a project and say, well, can we take the risk out of here? Well, one of the risks they would identify is, where is this feedstock coming from? You know, where are we going to get this grass straw? Where are we going to get this food waste, et cetera? So what we would envision is an ownership structure. We would like to look at some of those who produce that feedstock, the agricultural producers of it, being included in the ownership of it. That does a couple of things. It gives us an ability to have a long-term supply of that feedstock with a pretty high confidence factor. It allows us to work with those who produce it in foreign partnerships for several reasons. One, can we use the byproducts to return to the land to replace some nutrients that may have been lost? Can we work together to develop new feedstocks, etc.? So if that answers your question.
It does, Mr. Chair, and I just want to... One of my concerns when I voted for some things last session and against others, but one of the concerns I voiced loudest was that the farmers actually reap some of the benefits, and that's exactly what you just said. And you answered my other question about where does the 50,000 tons go? You just plow it right back into the land then, I assume?
Right.
There are multiple alternatives, and that's some of the things. I know your time is short, so I'll try and briefly tell you a little bit about, in summing up, I think Dave and Mike did an excellent job of giving you an overview of this. And where we're at now is we need to be able to get it funded. I didn't get into this, and I know Mike didn't, or Roger, to just create a study to put in the file cabinet somewhere. We want to build these projects, okay, and they scale. We could build them in multiple locations around this state. Rarely do you get to see, such a win-win here. I mean, you've got the ability to produce renewable energy, agricultural-based renewable energy that's going to help us meet our state RPS goals. It's going to keep money in our state rather than just outflowing from it. The size of these projects are community scale. So in other words, what I mean by that is they're not a 100 or a 200 million gallon facility put somewhere, or a very large power plant that then everything is decentralized. They're meant to be structured such that the waste stream that produces the energy is produced locally, processed locally, and consumed locally. And that's about as good a footprint as you can get energy basis-wise all the way.
And Mr. Chair, I have to go, but may I have one more question?
Yes, Representative.
How many employees would be employed at that plant? And I'd imagine that, and would they be getting paid family wages?
And yes. The answer is correct. So on this other sheet, we also break down the construction jobs and the employees.
Okay.
Basically, at opening, 16 full-time positions, and at full ramp-up, about 30 full-time positions.
There would be per plant. And there would be a couple of, there would be some day laborer types of jobs at these facilities, unloading trucks and some other things. But you're going to have engineers at these sites. These are all computer controlled. And we're not inventing anything new. In Europe, this is all off the shelf. I mean, literally, there's numerous companies that produce each of these elements. So folks are trained in how to operate these things, and then they take over operation of them.
Thank you. The income taxes to the state of Oregon at our 9% rate alone would pay off the minor investment we'd have to make to take this the next step in probably a couple months, certainly within the first year, definitely in the biennium. I'm certain of that.
Good bill should pass.
I got to get out of LC first, my friend.
You know, just in continuing on, we need to, and we use the model that the Department of Energy uses when they say, hey, if you're going to come in here and ask us for a loan, we want to see a business plan, and these are the elements we want to see in it at a minimum. That's what's on the screen here. In order to do that to the level required to go to the financing community, as Mike said, and as we're all aware, this is, you know, there's, I can't think of a worse time to try and raise capital than we've seen. So that means you've got to really do an excellent job on the front end in order to approach people and get them to commit. And I think it's important that we have a private sector capital in this. You know, they're looking at mitigating risk, as I said earlier. What we want to do in this business plan is drill down in each particular area so that we make sure when we go to that capital community that we've got all of the questions we could anticipate answered. Having raised capital before, I think I've got a fair idea of what those would be. But in this case, we need to refine and kind of take a very close, sharp look at what are the technologies we're going to use. They're going to be off the shelf, but how do we optimize them by working together in an integrated fashion? How do we make sure that the feedstock relationships are established in a way that is comfortable for the investor and the provider of those? So a lot of the normal things you would think about in terms of if you were looking at an investment opportunity, what would you want to have seen covered? That's what we need to drill down on and have and create a document that's usable. But as I said earlier, its intent is for funding to build things, not just to sit. We've been successful. We've got about 200 to 250,000 of the 350,000 we had budgeted this at, and we're here today to ask you to help us fill that gap if you can. We'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Chair, I might just comment that the state of Idaho spent $1 million on a business plan for a similar kind of thing. We're talking about $350,000 because we're going to use some of that that they've already spent $1 million on. So that's why we're trying to get it done cheaper.
And again, remind me how much the seed council, essentially through the fund, has already donated.
Put in $350,000, funded the feasibility study, $250,000 initially. It's the only cash that's gone into the project, and then another $100,000 to seed the business plan, which has brought about the other commitments that some real dollars are in there.
Significant. And again, conceivably, field burning, I like to call it thermal sanitation, it could be reduced in a kind of a win-win way by up to 50%?
That was our original conversation and goal between the commissioners and the industry, is that and that would be a significant gain for everyone involved.
It might be interesting to add from the agricultural aspect that there are other straws and other ag residues that may be able to be used in here. And if we see our export markets on some of those things begin to collapse, which we may, this could be an alternative use for that. So it has wider implications than one might think.
Other questions for these fine gentlemen? Yes. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Other testimony, or are you guys done? You got some?
Here to answer questions.
There to look good.
You sure? Because I just want to divert for just a second, and hopefully we can do some more brainstorming. This is very stimulating and exciting. I'm working on a project with the Northwest Hydrogen Alliance, so I just want you to note that there might be synergy here. Not only can I envision a joint project, but at least exchange of information because of what they're trying to do, business plan, government money that doesn't cost taxpayers any money. And lastly, their model of a foundation that keeps the technology, they're not trying to get rich off this, they're just in the hydrogen application, mm-hmm. they're trying to just protect their intellectual property, so to speak, and make sure it stays in Oregon or in the Northwest. And I think there's a great opportunity to talk. So that's my one little diversion, other than to say I'm very supportive and eager. Is there any precedent for sending a bill to the floor without the
without having it coming from LC?
Because I second his motion, and let's vote.
Yeah, conceptual amendment of no bill. We're not even in a work session yet. You notice the lack of panic on my face when the two Republicans you sit in between left the room.
Amazing.
So the other little that was his line originally. It's beautiful. The other issue is Chemeketa is interested in doing some stuff, and I sent them your way to come talk and see if there's any partnership. I guess they got a staff person working on vineyard clippings and you know some things that they're interested in. So a lot of opportunities, but. Thank you to your growers for the several hundred thousand dollars they've spent already trying to develop a win-win, and the Lane County commissioners that helped say, you know, that we're not just going to have an ongoing, bloody, pointless political battle about thermal sanitation.
Thank you. I'll pass it on.
With that, I'm going to close the hearing. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.